Freund Ehrlich hat nicht gesagt, dass ich werde nicht reden in Jiddisch. Es kommt mir ein bisschen schwer zu reden in Jiddisch. If ich kann in der Heim, ich kann reden in Jiddisch. Es ist eine Frage von Weinen und Klagen, ich kann reden in Jiddisch. Aber von Ideologie ist es sehr schwer zu reden in Jiddisch. Es ist sehr schwer zu reden in Englisch auch von Ideologie, weil es ist ein falsches Wort. Es ist ein Wort, was es ist eine, Englisch, eine einzige Sprache. Und ich denke, efter die einzige Weg, wir können reden von die Jargon von Ideologie, ist reden durch ein Jargon, was man ruft Soziologie. So heute, ich gehe zu ich reden in zwei Jargonen, das Problem von Ideologie durch die Sprache von Soziologie. I'll now have to abandon my efforts of poor Yiddish and speak in English. The word ideology has so many ambiguous meanings and emotional colorations. What is not an ideology today? Ideas, ideals, beliefs, passions, values, Weltanschauungs, religions, political philosophies, moral justifications, etc., etc. One hears about communism and capitalism as competing ideologies, about the ideology of small businessmen, about the failure of the United States to develop an ideology, or even sometimes the failure of the American labor movement to develop an ideology, and sometimes people even speak, pace the word, the end of ideology. Recently, in an essay in Partisan Review on pornography, ideology is defined as, quote, fantasy cast in the form of opinion or assertion, a loose and associative form of thought sharing qualities in common with pornography itself. A front page essay in the Times Literary Supplement on pre-Christian religious tracts discusses the effects of trafficking in hostile ideologies, referring to early Epicureanism in this respect as a hostile ideology for Christian apologists. And recently, a sociological colleague sent me an essay entitled Change, Ferment, and Ideology in the Social Services in Rochester, New York. Surely by now, some specified meanings should have developed out of common usage, and yet it has not. The word remains both descriptive and pejorative, both analytical and normative. The word does not remain neutral. Neither do the people who are influenced by ideology. In fact, in talking about the end of ideology, one is sometimes accused of calling for the end of all idealism. Ideologies, because they somehow catch up one's passions, move people to action. This is the source of their power. And in a world committed to change, often quite violent change, ideologies themselves become prime agencies of change. There is little point in all these confused goings on of attempting a formal definition of ideology. The term has shifted so much over time. Let me distinguish, therefore, historically, three aspects of the term or the concept of ideology to see if some clarity can be obtained in understanding how the concept has functioned in different ways. One crucial tradition which has shaped the idea or the word ideology is the argument that all ideas are conditioned. They're class conditioned, zeitgebunden, language-bound, according to theories of war, for example, and others. In one important sense, Marxism is the source of this idea. But as it developed, at least in the academic world, the chief stimulus was the idealist school of historical relativists, particularly Diltai. If all ideas are relative, if all history is relative or time-bound or conditioned in one way or another, how does one actually know what went on in a previous time? How can one gain a sense of truth about events? Such questions led in the work of Scheler, of Durkheim, Sorokin, Mannheim, and others to the sociology of knowledge. This is then the problem of the social determination of ideas. When Mannheim, for example, talks of thought as ideological and utopian, he is distinguishing two modes or two styles of thinking in relation to a time perspective. A second historical usage is to look at ideas not in terms primarily of what they say, or even if they're true or false, but in terms of their function, to see, so to speak, who is served. Ideas thus are reduced to some subsurface role. The interest in this case is less on the origin of ideas, but on their consequences. In part, this is an aspect of pragmatism. In greater measure, it belongs to Marxism in the Marxist tradition, and the vulgar version, all ideas come down to the question of ki ganya, katokavo, who wins, who loses. Thus, ideas are seen as instrumental in one sense or as completely functional. The emphasis then is not on the truth of the ideas, but the function they serve. The third and most common pattern today in talking about ideologies is to see them as social formulae, as myths, as means of mobilizing people, as belief systems. Here, the instrumental and functional aspects become converted into action. Now, all social movements, to some extent, use ideas in an instrumental way as calls for action. But the most extreme experience we have had is that has been of a Leninist pattern. Because in Leninism, we've had the creation of ideology as a way of life, of all life, of all action judged in terms of an ideological function. Now, these are rather rough and almost crude distinctions, and yet I use that in order to begin a point of analysis. In this paper, I shall not discuss the sociology of knowledge because it does not lend itself to the problem of social movements. I shall discuss my categories 2 and 3, which the analysis of ideology, so to speak, is a function of ideas and the role of ideology in belief systems. The analysis of ideology belongs properly to the discussion of the intelligentsia. One can say that what the priest is to religion, the intellectual is to ideology. This in itself gives us a clue to the dimensions of the word and the reason for its multivariate functions. The word ideology, as most of you may know, was coined by the French philosopher, D'Estaing de Tracy, at the end of the 18th century. It was, in its beginning, an Enlightenment term and was part of Enlightenment philosophy, notably used by such materialists as Helvetius and Holbach. De Tracy was trying to discover a way of uncovering truth other than through faith or authority, the traditional methods encouraged by church and state. And equally under the influence of Francis Bacon and Hume, these men were seeking some way to eliminate the accidents of bias, the distortions of prejudice, the idiosyncrasies of upbringing, the interventions of self-interest, or the simple will to believe, all of which, like the shadows in Plato's cave, created the illusions of truth. Their aim was to purify ideas in order to achieve objective truth and to therefore correct thought. Some of them, Helvetius, for example, believed that one had to go back to the origin and development of ideas in order to see how distortions entered. De Tracy believed that one purified ideas by reducing them to sense perceptions. In this respect, a belated French variant of British empiricism with a barely concealed anti-religious bias. And De Tracy called this new science of ideas ideology. The negative connotations of the term arose with Napoleon. Having consolidated his power, Napoleon forbade the teaching of moral and political science at the Institut National and denounced as ideologues those irresponsible speculators who talked about liberty and progress, who were subverting morality and patriotism. Curiously, as a Republican, Napoleon had been sympathetic to the idea of the philosophers. As an emperor, he recognized the importance of religious orthodoxy for the maintenance of the state. Ideology became for Napoleon an epithet, a nickname described, as he said, every species of being who themselves did not think out of self-interest, but are taken up, as he said, by hot-brained boys and crazed enthusiasts. But it was with Marx that the word ideology went through some curiously different transmutations. For Marx, there are, so to speak, three different elements in the word ideology. In his work, The German Ideology, the idea or the word ideology was linked to philosophical idealism, or the conception that ideas are autonomous, that ideas independently have the power to reveal truth and consciousness. Of course, as we know from Marx as a materialist, this was false, since in that famous phrase, existence determined consciousness, rather than the other way around. Any attempt to draw a picture of reality from ideas alone could produce only false consciousness. Thus, for example, in following Feuerbach, from whom Marx drew most of his analysis of ideology and alienation, he considered religion to be a false consciousness. Gods are the creation of men's minds. They only appear to exist independently and determine man's fate, but they do not, and therefore religion is an illusion. Religion, therefore, is an ideology. But Marx went one step further. Ideologies, he said, are not only false ideas, but they mask particular interests. Ideologies claim to be truth, but reflect the needs of specific groups. In his early essays on the Jewish question, one of the few places where he dealt specifically with philosophical problems of state and society, Marx sharply attacked the concept of natural rights, as it appeared in the French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man, and as these rights were specified in the state constitutions of Pennsylvania and New Hampshire. Some of you who've read these essays may recall that it has very little to do, in most of it, with the question of the Jews alone, except for the beginning and the end. Most of it has to do with the analysis primarily of this problem of the nature of natural rights. The presumption of natural rights, the freedom to worship, or the freedom to own property, was, in this respect, at least within the constitutions of New Hampshire and Pennsylvania as he saw it, or in the Declaration of the French Revolution, supposed to be absolute or transcendent rights. For Marx, they were only bourgeois rights, historically achieved, and therefore having a false claim to universal validity. The function of the state, Marx had pointed out, was to create some basis for the general will. In the civil society, which the bourgeoisie had created, the state presumably had to be negative or neutral. Each man would pursue his own self-interest, and a social harmony would prevail. But in fact, he argued, the state was used to enforce the rights of particular groups. Thus, the claim of natural rights simply masked the demand of the bourgeoisie to be able to use property to their own advantage. Marx believed that the individualism of natural rights was a false individualism, since man could only realize himself in community. And the true freedom was not freedom of property or freedom of religion, but freedom from property and freedom from religion. In short, a freedom from ideology. The attempt, therefore, to claim universal validity for what was, in fact, class interest was, therefore, ideology. Marx differed from Bentham and other utilitarians in recognizing that individuals were not always motivated by direct self-interest. This, he said, was vulgar hedonism. Ideology, he said, was a meaningful force. He wrote in the 18th Brumaire, "One must not form the narrow-minded idea that the petty bourgeoisie wants on principle to enforce an egoistic class interest. It believes, rather, that the special conditions of its emancipation are the general conditions through which alone modern society can be saved and class struggle avoided." The unmasking of ideology, thus, is to reveal the objective interest behind the idea and to see what function the ideology serves. The implications of all this are quite direct. For one, a rationalistic analysis of politics alone is inadequate. What people say they believe cannot always be taken at face value, and one must search for the structure of interest beneath the ideas. One, therefore, looks not at the content of ideas, but at their function. A second, more radical conclusion is that if ideas mask material interests, then the test of a truth of a doctrine is to see what class interests are served. In short, truth becomes a class truth. There's no objective philosophy, but only bourgeois philosophy and proletarian philosophy. No objective sociology, but only bourgeois sociology and proletarian sociology. But Marxism is not simply a relativistic doctrine. There is an objective ordering of the social universe which is revealed through history. History for Marx, for Hegel, is, of course, a progressive unfolding of reason, in which society, through man's conquest of nature and the destruction of all mythologies and superstition, moves on to higher stages. The truth of doctrine, therefore, is to be determined by its closeness of fit to the development of history. And in practice, this has meant that the truth was determined by whether or not it contributed to the advancement of revolution. Now, there are many difficulties taking ideology here as a means of dealing with the function of ideas. There are many difficulties to this theory in its way. One is the role of science. Marx did not speak of natural science as ideologies. Yet a number of Marxists, particularly in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, did claim that there was a bourgeois science, there was a bourgeois physics even, and a proletarian science and proletarian physics. Thus, the relativity theories of Albert Einstein were attacked as idealistic. And while today in the Soviet Union there is hardly any talk of bourgeois physics, the theories of Sigmund Freud are officially condemned as idealistic. Yet if science is not class-bound, and by and large there is the tacit assumption, at least in the physical sciences, that it's not class-bound, is this equally true of the social sciences? The question of the autonomy of science is one that has never been satisfactorily resolved in Marxist thought. A second difficulty is the deterministic presumption that there's a one-to-one correspondence between a set of ideas and some class purpose. Yet this is rarely the case. Empiricism is usually associated with liberal inquiry. Yet David Hume, the most radical empiricist, was a Tory. And Edmund Burke, who would argue the most vigorously against rationalist efforts to blueprint the new society and believed only in empiricism, was a conservative. Hobbes, one of the most profound of materialists, was a royalist. And T.H. Green, one of the leaders of the idealist revival in Great Britain, a liberal. Therefore, it is hard to see in any direct way the so-called relationship between ideas themselves and presumably the kinds of interests that are wholly served. The third difficulty, of course, is that if ideas are presumably serve the function of one class or another, is the definition of class. For Marx himself, the idea of class was never rigorously defined in his work. The key social divisions arose out of the distribution of property. Yet in a politico-technological world, property has increasingly lost its force as a determinant of power and sometimes even of wealth. In almost all modern societies, technical skill becomes more important than inheritance as the determinant of occupation, and political power takes precedence over economic. In what sense, therefore, can one take, at least in Marxist terms, a traditional definition of class? And yet, one cannot, of course, discount the force of the proposition that styles of thought are related to historic class groups and their interests, or that ideas emerge as a consequence of different worldviews or perspectives of different groups in society. The problem, so to speak, is how to specify the relationship between the existential base and the mental production. Max Weber, the sociologist, for example, argued that there's an elective affinity, using the old term of Goethe, between ideas and interests. The social origin of an idea, or of a theory, or even of a theorist himself, is less relevant than the fact that certain ideas become selected out, so to speak, by social groups that find them congenial and thus espouse them. And this was the basis for the familiar theory by now of the Protestant ethic, in which he argued that certain features of Calvinist thought and the kind of personality that such a doctrine sanctioned became necessary and causal in the development of capitalism, despite the otherworldly foundation of these ideas. Mannheim sought to divide social thought into two fundamental styles, which he called ideological and utopian. He accepted the proposition that ideas are time-bound, but insisted that Marx's ideas, as those of all socialists, came within the same stricture. Since all ideas serve interests, those which defend the existing order he called ideological, and those which sought to change the social order he called utopian. But was all effort then at objective truth hopeless? Was the quest, therefore, that Francis Bacon initiated a mirage? Mannheim did feel that one social group could be relatively objective, the intellectuals. Since the intelligentsia was a floating stratum in society, and therefore less bound than any other class groups, they could achieve what he called multi-perspective, that transcended the parochial limits of other social groups. This is a problem which I simply leave for the moment and would pass on. I think by and large, as any subsequent discussion of ideology will show, that this conception was itself quite false. In the development of the social sciences, the problems raised by Bacon, de Tracy, Marx, and others, the clarification of the role of ideas in social change have become part of the sociology of knowledge. And as I said, this is a problem which, for the moment, I leave outside this paper. But in popular usage, the word ideology remains as vague a term as it ever was, before even the whole intrusion of academic analysis. It becomes simply a term to denote a worldview or a belief system or creeds held by social groups about the social arrangements in society. People then talk of the ideology of small businessmen or the ideology of liberalism or the ideology of fascism, etc. Some writers will talk of the dream world of ideology in which Americans see their country as a place where every child is born to equality of opportunity, etc. In this sense, then, ideology connotes a myth rather than such a set of values. Clearly, such usages, by mixing together many things, create only confusion. And perhaps a simple distinction can be in order. I borrow here a distinction made by Mannheim between what he called a particular conception of ideology and a total conception of ideology. In the first sense, we can say that individuals who profess certain values do have interests as well, and we understand better the meaning of these values or beliefs, or the reasons why they come forth when they have, by linking them up with the interests they have, though the interests may not always be economic. They may be status interests, such as those of an ethnic group that wants higher standing or social approval in society. They may be political interests and such. It is in this sense that we can talk of the ideology of business or of labor and the like. A total ideology is something different. It's an all-inclusive system of comprehending reality. It is a set of beliefs infused with passion which seeks to transform a whole way of life. This commitment to ideology, the yearning for a cause, or the satisfaction of deep moral feelings, is not necessarily the reflection of interests in the shape of ideas. Ideology in this sense, in the sense we use it here then, becomes a form of secular religion. While ideologies in their content specify certain values, the most important latent function is to mobilize emotional energies. The taproots of emotion, especially irrational emotion, run deep in the human personality. One of the prior functions of religion was that it could draw out these emotions into a symbolic whole through the litany, through the liturgy, the sacraments, the temples, the religious arts. Ideology fuses these energies and channels them into politics. The modern effort to transform the world chiefly through politics has meant that the political arena has become the basic cockpit of emotions. A social movement, therefore, rouses people when it can do three things: when it simplifies ideas, establishes a claim to truth, and in the union of these two, demands a commitment to action. Thus, not only does ideology transform ideas, it seeks to transform people as well. Now, All social movements, to some extent, in one way or another, in the claims they make on people, have this kind of ideological function. The most extreme version that we've seen in our own time has been, fundamentally, the Bolshevik version, the Leninist conception of a total commitment to revolution, of a total commitment to the way of life. The curious thing that was for Lenin, Marxism itself was an ideology. As I said earlier, if one looks at ideology primarily in its analytical sense, as a form of illusion, which will be ended. In fact, the first person ever to use the phrase the end of ideology was Engels in his essay on Feuerbach, which he said, when people would then see clearly when there would be no more distinction between necessity and freedom, there would be, in effect, an end of ideology in this respect. But the point of using Marxism as an ideology was very much on the mind of Lenin because, by and large, it became a system of ideas to focus, guide, and energize masses of people. But more than simply to instill ideals in people and to give them consciousness or to lift up their consciousness, it was also a way of manipulating them. There is by now the standard notion, of course, that in the Leninist conception, there's the idea of the vanguard and the mass of the cadres in a large movement, the idea fundamentally of directing bodies. But Leninism was not only, so to speak, an organizational revolution in Marxism, not only a means of transforming politics by the idea of small cadres and professional revolution directing force, but equally, it was a symbolic revolution. And if one reads what is to be done as one of the canonical texts, for example, as to what Leninism means, one can also read such essays as the one called On Slogans, which Lenin wrote in the middle of 1917, to see the way in which the manipulation of large masses of people operates on the symbolic level as well. One finds put forth the idea of a party line, a means of establishing a set of simplified fundamental themes, of tapping large sections of opinion which are far removed fundamentally from what the party itself stands for by relating slogans to generalized emotions. Thus, you not only have an organizational conception of ideology in Lenin's sense, one has, I've said, the second conception, which is a symbolic one as well. In these terms, ideology then becomes a vocabulary. It becomes a set of terms that define a world. And where one has a combat party, it becomes a means of defining the enemy and of specifying one's goals. Ideologies, by producing comprehensive theories of politics, make it unnecessary to deal with individual issues and individual merits. A man with an ideology can experience a sense of being well-informed because he reads the newspapers as a way of confirming his own beliefs. And yet, this form of ideology, it seems to me, necessarily produces its own inherent corruption. Because ideology, which arises as a need to find a formula for the variety of experience, ends as a denial of experience. Where one has a total ideology, the denial of any particular tenets become a challenge to the assumptions of faith. Let me therefore, in more schematic form, indicate what I mean by the notion that any ideology, particularly ideologies which come into power, necessarily suffer from inherent corruption. The first is the fairly obvious fact, which one can see spelled out immediately in terms of the present Sino-Soviet conflict, that conflicts of interest, and I do believe in its origin they were very deep conflicts of interest become translated necessarily into conflicts of ideology. And issues which in other cases between groups, and after all conflict in itself in the world has to be mediated in one way or other unless one resorts to war, issues which in other instances could be contained on the basis of interests become widened into general conflicts purely as ideologies or as secular religions. A second aspect that as any system of power begins moving in terms of trying to adapt to reality, specific elements of the ideology fall into discard, because they no longer fit the situation. One can see in the whole history of Bolshevism and power, from the very beginning, the constant discard of specific aspects of the original ideology of the movement. The very first thing which went into discard was the notion of equality, of equal wages, of equal place in the ranks, and various other aspects which one can find spelled out, for example, in State and Revolution. So to this extent, the notion of ideology, the function of ideology, still to be effective, has to be removed from mediated elements. It therefore has to take on an aura of sacredness and abstractness, which no longer becomes tied into the specific reality of the world around one. The creation of ideology as a further abstraction means, therefore, a greater dependence upon faith and on persons chosen to embody it. And therefore, one risks, in this particular case, the risk of disillusion. And one finds, of course, in the 20th Congress speech in 1956, the utmost repudiation of ideology in this respect, the disillusionment with Stalin as the person who had embodied all the wisdom and faith of the ideology itself. To the extent that one still needs this kind of ideology as a form of belief, the ideology now becomes tied not with the person, but with the infallibility of the institution. Therefore, not even the creed alone or the person, but now an institution becomes an embodiment of ideology. Today, the central feature of Soviet ideology is not the formal content of any doctrine, but simply the idea of Partii Nost, the idea that the faith in the collective wisdom of the party will always and each time come through and therefore save the day. And yet this form of ideology, too, ultimately risks its own form of corruption. I was reading the other day, and I perhaps thought it was the simplest illustration I knew of a first-hand report of what happened in these particular cases. It's a statement by a Czech writer, unsigned, which appeared in the recent issue of Survey. He's talking about people who've grown up in a world where ideology themselves had shaped the world, rather than a world in which people had used ideology to change the world. He's talking about the young people, the young generation of his time. And I quote, "A strange, frightening breed, this new generation. These men and women born during the last war or even later, who never knew any other social order and who were the product of our society. Purposeful, tough, smart, resourceful in handling their own affairs, down to earth, uncommunicative outside their own group, full of obvious pity for their fathers and their ridiculous maneuvers, full of energy to get the best out of life now and for themselves. To them, ideology and politics, and indeed any form of public activity, are a lot of bunk, just hollow words with little relation to reality. Not that they are anti-communists, a meaningless term in their ears, they just could not care less. They were born into socialism, and they live in socialism, and what they see around is socialism. Pretty dull and shabby, and certainly nothing much to write home about. If there's still to come the final ignominy and the burial of Marxism-Leninism as we understand it today, it'll be effortlessly carried out by these generations already born into socialism. And so it should be. For I believe that these young people, these young socialists, will at last realize, because of what we did, that there's no socialism without freedom, and that life is more important than ideology. This, at least, is my hope, the only one I sincerely and truly have." To this extent, it seems to me one has, in these instances I've tried to spell out, the notion of the inherent corruption of ideology, almost in a parallel way as one can say that there is an inherent law of oligarchy within the nature of social movements. To sum up in this respect, on the second aspect of what I'm talking about of ideology, ideology always plays a positive role where movements are out of power in focusing and energizing ideas, when a movement is essentially a combat movement and therefore can provide a guide, a focus, an ideal in this particular respect. In power, the movements become, in this respect, corrupt, disillusioned, cynical, and to that extent, therefore, ultimately itself a barrier to all social progress. Thank you.